Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and my mission is to bring you the most interesting entrepreneurs, authors, speakers, and business people that I can find. And these people are excited to freely share their business wisdom, tips, and actionable advice with us every week. Today, I welcome back to the show my friend, Bob Berg. He is the author of several books, including one that we'll talk about today, titled Adversaries and Allies, Win People Over Without Manipulation or Coercion, which Bob feels is his most important work yet. Read the book. I think you'll agree with him. He says that you can systematically and consistently get the results you want from others while making them feel genuinely good about themselves, about the process, and about you. It's a big claim, and Bob is here to share his reasoning with us. Bob is an advocate, supporter, and defender of the free enterprise system, believing that the amount of money one makes is directly proportional hello, to how many people they serve. He is also an unapologetic animal fanatic and serves as a member of the board of directors of Furry Friends Adoption and Clinic in Jupiter, Florida. That last little paragraph right there is why Bob and I get along so well. We have the same belief systems, and we're both animal nuts. We're owned by animals. That's all there is to it. Bob, good morning. I'm so glad you're here, and welcome back to Your Partner in Success Radio.
Good morning to you, Denise. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Oh, it's always so much fun. I was walking around this morning, oh, I get to talk to Bob. Oh, I get to talk to Bob. So, here you are. So anyway, for those of our audience who maybe have not heard our other interviews or have not maybe really heard of you, which I find astonishing, tell them who you are and where they can find you.
Well, I am Bob Berg, A-A-N-G, which stands for All Around Nice Guy.
Yeah,
and they can find. They can find me at berg.com.
Good enough. Well, listen, I know you've written several books, and I have them all. And your publisher sent me your latest one. Thank you, by the way. I really appreciate that. It's a great book. It really is. And I spent the weekend reading it and going over it. And one of my favorite chapters, I have to tell you, and I hope I'm not giving much away, is Persuasion Secrets of a 10-Year-Old.
Yeah.
I love that chapter.
That was a lot of fun, wasn't it?
I bet, because you and I both, anybody who has been around children, was a child or has children, knows that there's no better salesperson in the world than a child who will not deviate from what they want, period. They know how to get it, they're going to get it, and nothing gets in their way.
Yeah, and that particular one, and that story was told to me by her grandmother.
Couldn't
have been any better as far as really tapping into every principle of persuasion that you can possibly do, including the biggest part, and that was once she got what she wanted, coming through and doing everything she promised, which then, you know, said to her grandma, okay, well, I can trust her. She earned my trust.
Right. That's so important, and I think that's where a lot of salespeople or online business people maybe miss the mark, because they're making these big promises, but they haven't established that trust.
Well, yeah, and you do need to usually establish that trust before someone's going to take action, unless the person who is buying is looking for something for nothing, and they're the type to buy into any promises, and then they're going to be disappointed, and they're then never going to do business with that person again. So, yeah, you do need to come through on what you promise, and typically, in order to get the business in the first place, you already have to have established that trust. As I always say, all things being equal, people will do business with and refer business to those people they need. know, like, and trust, they'll mm-hmm. also allow themselves to be influenced by those people they know, like, and trust. So that usually comes first. And then, of course, once the person does buy from you, you've got to have delivered on everything you promised and then some. And to the degree you do that, that's the degree that now you're going to have a person who will do business with you again and most likely tell others about you.
Mm-hmm. I agree. And I've heard you say that, know, like, and trust so many times, and it's absolutely critical. And I think more and more people are kind of coming over to your side of thinking. I think they're understanding, particularly with social media, mm-hmm. and social media marketing, that you've got to establish that kind of baseline that you're not going to grab their money, run, and never respond to their help desk issues.
Right.
So.
Right. And I think more and more people do know that. And you know, most people are business people who do understand that they've got to please the customer. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's really what it's all about. Not only because it's the right way to be, which in and of itself, that's a good reason, but in a free marketplace where nobody is forced to buy from you, they're only going to buy from you and do business with you again because they know that they're going to get back much more in value than what they exchange in price, and that's fine. That's the way it should be.
Absolutely. When I introduced you, we talked about pets. My dog right now is standing on my foot. I'm not sure why, because she just came in from her squirrel chasing activities. She has, you know, times. I mean, she has a little doggy watch, and she knows what time the squirrels are out there.
Yeah,
but for some reason, she's very anxious. I think it's the weather, but I know that you have a cat, and I would love for you to tell people your cat story because it's a great one. And isn't there a chapter in the book about your cat?
Yeah, there are a couple of Liberty the Cat stories. One was when she and I first met, she was a stray, and we're still not sure if she was feral or just stray, but she was, you know, she was very hungry, and she was scared and angry looking, and one of my neighbors actually saw her first, and she came in to get me to let me know there was a starving cat out there. And so we got some cat kibble and put it in a bowl and put it, we tried to approach her, but of course she was very skittish and wouldn't let us even get near her. So, you know, eventually I just put the bowl down and then we just backed off and let her come to the bowl when she was mm-hmm. ready to, and she did, and she ate. And for the next, probably for the next week, what I would do is when I'd go out and feed her, I'd bring the bowl a little bit closer to my house every time, but I'd stay, you know, away. I'd get in the distance so she could see me there and get comfortable with me, but I was far enough away that she always knew she had an escape route. She never had to worry. Yeah, and then I brought the bowl to my back door outside the patio, and again, she'd come and eat, and, you know, I really wanted to have her as my cat, and I wanted to be her human, and so I thought, you know, little by little, we can get her used to me. But the big thing was to always give her an out, so she never felt threatened. Mm. And we'll tie mm-hmm. this in a moment to the persuasion process. But the next step was that I had the bowl inside the patio. But the door was open. It was always ajar, so she could escape. And then the next thing was I opened up the window separating my house from the patio, and she actually, I could put the bowl inside, but she was out, you know, she was outside, but her head was inside to eat, and again, she was fine. Now, eventually, mm-hmm. she actually came in the house right next to the door, and I'd keep the door open. And then I thought, okay, I wonder if I can close the door and have her comfortable. So I started to just very gently close the door. And as soon as I did, she, you know, looked up and she was looking mm-hmm. for the back door. And so I immediately just opened it even wider. And she just sort of thought about it and went back to eating. And then I gently closed the door behind her and she was fine. And then, you know, eventually it got to the point she could just, you know, had the run of the house, and she knew she'd go out, let her out when she wanted to be let out, and she could come in when she wanted to come in. And that was fine. But the big thing was, and this is, I think, the key lesson when it comes to dealing with anyone, is that she always had an out or a back door. So she never felt as though she was being trapped. And it's the same with the humans, with the two-leggeds that we deal with. It's not that they want to say no. It's that they want to know that they can say no. They want to know that they control their destiny, so to speak. And so what you want to do is give a person an out or a back door. And what I call Berg's Law of the out or back door is that the bigger the out or back door you give someone to take, the less they'll feel the need to take it. It's only when people feel pressured that they look for an escape route. When there's no pressure, it's not an issue. And so yeah. We can do that, whether it's calling someone and simply saying to the person, hey, do you have a quick second, or did I catch you at a really bad time? And mm-hmm. A person might say, well, but aren't you just giving them the excuse to get you off the phone? Well, if they wanted to get you off the phone anyway, then they would, you know, or they'd be angry right. that you're, you know what I'm saying? So when you do this, they, even if it isn't the best time, they're much more likely to say, well, you know, I'm about to go into a meeting, but can you call me at so-and-so, or can I call you back? Mm-hmm. Or what they'll often say is, well, I've got a real quick minute. What can I do for you? And then, of
right,
course, when
right.
you lead in with something that's of benefit to them, then it's up to you to keep them interested. But what you've done is you've shown respect and you've given them an out. You have not made them feel pressured. It's like when you start a sales presentation, you might say, you know, this may or may not be for you. It's not for everyone. And when you do that, what you're doing right away is you know, communicating to that person, there's no pressure. It's going to be up
they
to you.
They have options. Right.
Up to being more interested.
Right. And see, I have always done that with the telephone, whether it's family, friends, my mother, it doesn't matter. I always, because, look, literally when I'm on the phone with them, I have stepped into their office or their living room, wherever they happen to be. Mm-hmm. And it behooves me to say, do you have a moment? Is this a good time? That's just common courtesy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, exactly. Another
way of giving.
There's nothing
worse than a phone call where they just launch at you and you're like, whoa, hang on. So,
exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
I'm sorry I interrupted. What were you going to say?
Oh, that's okay. It's also another great way of giving someone an out is when you're seeing someone who maybe you met once or twice, you're not sure that they necessarily would remember your name. And so what you do is you just make sure you go up to them and, you know, I would say, hi, Dave, Bob Berg, we met, you know, 2 months ago,
right.
or, you know, whatever. And so you give them your name so that they can then say, oh, sure, Bob, of course, I remember you, or, you know, what have you. And even if they don't, that's okay. You gave them the out. You made them feel comfortable. Instead, if I just said, oh, hey, Dave, how's it going? You know, that sort of thing. And he's looking at me. He can't quite remember, and he's embarrassed. And what we've done is we've made a person feel badly. We've them on the spot. And cause them to be defensive and uncomfortable. And if they're uncomfortable, they're going to be uncomfortable with us as human beings. So the,
right.
the more you can make a person comfortable, give that person the out or the back door, that's always going to come back to you.
But where did we kind of as people get off the rail on this? Because everything you're describing to me is just pure common sense. But
well,
it seems that most people don't know to do this, and I'm always surprised.
I suspect it's probably always been that way. I mean, I think we're less polite as a society to a certain point,
yeah.
but I think people have always been people. You know, people have, by and large, not really thought. the majority of people pretty much allow themselves to be ruled both in thought and action. And, you know, really part of success in life is being willing to think and being willing to think past the surface of things.
Mm-hmm.
And
good
I think
point.
In this book, what I've tried to do is provide a system, if you will, or provide a guide to just being able to very easily, very simply master those people skills that so often make a difference. You know, you can have most of the greatest success traits working for you. You know, when you think of it, you can be very talented. You can be of extremely high character. You can be ambitious, kind, charitable, hardworking, thrifty, energetic. You can have a knack for numbers and a head for business. You can be even tempered and creative. And, you know, hey, Denise, all that's great. It's wonderful, in fact. However, unless you can influence others, move people to the desired and appropriate action, your chances of attaining really significant success are somewhat limited. I really believe, though, on the other hand, that when combining what I would call benevolent intent and a learned skill set, which is what the book is about, a learned skill set, you really can find yourself constantly, consistently, and even predictably attaining both personal and business satisfaction while, of course, touching the lives of everyone you meet with really exceptional value. And I call this ultimate influence, which I define as simply the ability to get the results you want from others while helping them feel genuinely good about themselves.
Right.
And I, you know, so often this is the difference with people, because you get those people who have those character traits we were talking about, and they are very talented. And you know what? They achieve success too. And let's not denigrate that. They achieve real legitimate success. But then you see someone else who maybe is not as talented as they are, or maybe they're just as talented, but they have just really soared. You know, they've really gone head and shoulders in terms of success. And what's the difference? Often it's people skills. It's that person who can bring out the best, not only in themselves, but sort of bring out the best in everyone with whom they seem to interact. And really, that's, you know, that's the point of this book, to be able to equip people with those skills in a way that's very, very easy to learn.
Well, and I've heard people say, you know, people skills, or as I term them often, soft skills, can't be taught, and I disagree. I think they can't. I think you just need to be aware that those skills, you know, how to work with people, how to treat people, how to respond to people. You taught me a lesson that, and it was such a simple one, I'm still stunned that I didn't know it. But, you know, people will say something to me on Facebook or Twitter or even in person, they'll say, oh, well, you know, this was such a great thing you did, thank you so much, and I'll say, oh, you're welcome. I don't do that anymore because of Bob Berg. You taught me to say, oh, it's my pleasure, which is a completely different response, and it elicits a different response in the person I say that to. I never say, oh, you're welcome anymore. It's just too casual, and it means nothing. I never thought about it until you pointed, well, I asked you about it, and I went, I'll be darned. Really? Huh. How did I not know that? But I didn't know it. Something that
simple.
Well,
but that's why you're a winner,
though,
because you look at something and you say, should I apply it? And you do, because action is key. And it's not just having a good idea. Because remember, I didn't make that up, certainly. I learned it from someone else.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got to take the
information. But you passed it on.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And then we take action on those ideas, and you know, we see it works. The people at the you know, the adoption clinic where I work at Furry Friends, we've got them all now saying my pleasure when people call, and what a difference it makes. And people comment on how, you know, how great the staff is, the team is to deal with, and so forth. It just makes a huge difference.
Well, you know, your welcome is kind of a throwaway, isn't it? I mean, it really doesn't mean anything. You haven't given any thought to it. And I know I didn't when I would look back and say, oh, you're welcome. It's just an easy way. Most people, I know I am, I'm uncomfortable with compliments. They make me kind of go, ooh, did I really earn that? Did I deserve? I don't know what it is, but I think most people are a little bit uncomfortable with that. But to say my pleasure and mean it because I know that I helped you with something is a completely different mindset.
Yeah.
So
good,
thank
for you.
Thank you for that.
Pleasure.
There you go. And see, I believe you. I believe that you mean that. But
so
that goes, I know, but that goes back to what we're talking about, that these skills can be taught. I mean, they don't have to be part of your makeup when you're growing up as a child. I mean, you can learn them and adapt them and actively abide by them, I think is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, I mean, when people say it, something can't be taught, you know, sometimes people just say things to say things or you know, again, based on their belief system or their experience, and you know, that's fine. But, you know, because someone says something can't be taught or can be or not this or that, you know, unless we ask, how did they come to that conclusion, on what evidence, you know, what studies have they done or read that would say that that's not, you know, sometimes people just say things and they say them.
Well, I'm one for throwing things out just to see what happens. But I just do that for fun. Just like, let me see who, you know, if I can see sizzle coming out of their ears, I did my job. Sometimes it's just fun. But you know what I really want to ask you, Bob? The title of your book is, it's a very, very strong title. The word adversaries is, you know, that's kind of scary. How did you come up with turning adversaries into allies? I mean, where did the word adversaries come from, I guess, is my question.
Well, there's a saying from the sages of the Talmud that went, who is a mighty person? And the answer is that person who can control their own emotions and make of an enemy a friend. So of an enemy a friend would be sort of an adversary into an ally. And really, though, when we say adversaries in this book, we don't necessarily mean people who are purposely trying to cause you harm or even an enemy, which would be, I guess, the literal translation, but really just someone who, for whatever reason, including simply the context of the situation, might be standing in the way of your satisfaction. And this could be the person at the customer service desk when you bring back an item to exchange and you forgot you lost your receipt and they haven't been equipped to be able to work with you on helping to, you know what I'm saying, to work through that issue. So you've got to be able to talk with them in a way that's kind and tactful and respectful and effective. And it could be your boss who you're asking for a raise, or it could be pretty much anything. When I really think of adversaries, I love what the great the Hall of Fame Japanese home run hitter Sadaharu Oh used to say. And they used to call him the Japanese Babe Ruth because he was the all-time home run leader in Japan. And he used to say that he never saw the opposing pitchers as his adversaries, but rather as his partner in hitting home runs. And I thought that was really cool. And so, when I think of an adversary, I think of a person who is our partner in helping us attain satisfaction. That person's also our partner in personal growth, because really, when you think of it, the kind of person you need to become in order to consistently turn adversaries into allies really, really takes a step up for you in development. So that's another thing I hope to accomplish with this book, that it just gives people confidence to really know that they do have the ability to do this and be more effective.
Well, you don't have to be nasty all the time, and I think that's what so many people forget. And I was watching all these, during the recent cold snap when people were being stuck in airports. It's an act of God. Get over it. But people were just nasty, and they would be, it's not fair, and they remember, and it's like, really? Have you stepped outside? Can you see what's going on? And I remember being in a similar situation some years ago, and I had flown from the west part of the country back here, and we got stuck in Houston because the planes were iced. There was no way they were going to get us off the ground. And I knew that. And, what I did was I was very polite to the people who were telling me no, there were no more flights. And, they were just doing their job. They couldn't tell me what I wanted to know. They gave me the information they had. So, I gathered up everybody in my immediate vicinity. We opened up our suitcases, took out all our little hoarded snacks, and had a party. guess who got on the first planes?
Of course, absolutely.
It wasn't the people who were screaming.
Exactly.
So,
exactly.
I think people just forget that it's not all about them. They have to make the other person really want to help them out.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't do that by yelling at them.
Exactly, exactly. I just can't tell you how often I see that on an ongoing basis.
Mm-hmm. It's not logical.
Well, it's not logical, and people aren't logical. Human beings aren't logical. We're emotional creatures. That's why principle number one is control your own emotions. It's only when we can control our own emotions, when we're the boss of ourselves, only then are we in a position to be able to take a potentially negative situation or negative person and turn it into a situation where everyone comes away a winner. Everyone comes out ahead. We'd like to think that as human beings, we'd like to think of ourselves as being logical, but we are pretty much emotion driven. We make major decisions emotionally. We back up those decisions with logic. We rationalize, which simply means we tell ourselves rational lies. And we do that in order to justify the emotion-based decisions that we've made. Well, emotions often also come into play when someone does something to sort of push your buttons. And it could be purposefully, but just as often it's accidentally. They just say that or they do that thing that causes you to make yourself angry or mad or miserable or hurt or what have you. And when we're acting out of that emotion, we are not in a position of strength. we are in a position of weakness. And we become reactive rather than responsive. As Zig Ziglar used to say, reacting is negative, responding is positive. And he'd say, you know, did you respond well to the medication, or did you have a bad reaction? And that's really what it is. So we need to be able to be in control of our emotions. And as I say that, I think it's important, Denise, to qualify that statement, because it's very easy for people to think, well, gosh, are you saying, you know, don't be emotional, don't have emotion, are we supposed to be robots? No, absolutely not. Emotion's a wonderful thing. It's part of what makes life exciting and interesting and great. It's the only thing is, who's in control? Are you in control of your emotions, or are they in control of you? Dondi Scumaci, one of my great mentors, and I know you know Dondi. I love her too, and I love her saying. She says, by all means, take your emotions along for the ride, but make sure you are driving the car. And that's the key.
Yeah, she's right. And I've always said, you know, because when I was younger, I really let my emotions rule my world, and I made a muck up of things across the board. Not good. And I look back and go, ooh. But I also look back and go, ooh, lessons learned, because then I moved into my left brain where it's very clean and shiny and bright and left the excess baggage in my right brain. Although I do let my emotions take over every now and then when I have identified it to be healthy. But I always stop and think. I always take that half a heartbeat to identify, what am I going to do here? But one of the things that I've always said is, the minute you're in any kind of an altercation or argument with somebody, and the minute you raise your voice and start yelling, you have just given it up. Shut it down and walk away. You lost.
Yeah.
And people don't get that, and they just keep accelerating and accelerating. Right. It's just stupid.
Yeah. The interesting thing is that sometimes the best way to be heard is to lower your voice.
Oh, yeah.
Because as the volume escalates, we tend to think, oh, if I only yell a little bit louder, that person will hear me. Well, typically just the opposite. Their mind is probably made up, and they're more likely to just disregard that which doesn't fit into their already unconscious beliefs. But if we lower our voice and become calm, we draw that person back in. Plus, it puts us in a better state to be able to learn from them.
It does. And, you know, I've often warned people, you know, if there's something going on and you're trying for some reason to, let's just say assault, even though that's not the right word, but you're trying to overcome my will about anything, if my voice goes down an octave and I'm speaking very slowly, my best advice to you is get in your car and leave. You don't want me so angry that I'm speaking in a measured tone, in a very quiet tone. Go to another zip code. Call me later. It's not a good time. Yeah, I agree with you. I don't yell and scream. I just don't. It doesn't make sense, and it doesn't work.
No, it does not. Not if by work we mean get the results we want.
That's exactly right.
So if we mean work by mucking everything up and killing the whole thing, yeah, it works.
No. But, you know, you use the word influence a lot, and I read it in your book a lot. What do you mean by influence, Bob, and why is it so important?
Well, on a very basic level, Denise, influence is simply the ability to move a person or persons to a desired action, usually
without yelling.
Exactly. Usually within the context of a specific goal. On a bit deeper level, we could say that influence is an unseen flow of power. And while both definitions are correct, I don't believe either one really captures the essence of influence. I believe that when it comes right down to it, influence is pull. It's not push. We don't push people to do things and really get the results we want. We might get their compliance, but we will not get their commitment. You don't hear people say, there's a huge difference.
Yeah.
And you don't hear people say, wow, that Denise, she is so influential. She has a lot of push with people. You hear she has a lot of pull with people. That's what influence is. It's pull. It's an attraction. Great influencers attract people to themselves and to their ideas, and they do this, again, not through push, but through its opposite, pull. This pull we're speaking of, this pull is really a very legitimate form of power. power, because power is the opposite of force. Force is control. It's manipulation, intimidation, compliance. It's usually the result of it's a function of positional authority. In leadership teaching, it's actually called positional influence, right? The person has a title, department head, supervisor, manager, even employer. And hey, let's face it, even someone with just positional authority can still compel certain people to do certain things. I mean,
right,
obviously,
like a boss.
And the employee knows if they want any chance of advancement, a raise, a promotion, or to not be disciplined or punished or fired, they need to do what they're told. But that's compliance. And Denise, mm-hmm. I think the biggest challenge with trying to lead or influence through compliance is that at best, the person's going to do exactly what they're told. This is at best. They're going to do exactly what they're told and not one bit more. At worst.
And you see it all the time. They do it. They're sullen. They get it done. But, boy, they're not going to step. If they saw a problem hidden in the corner, there's a crack over there and you should get it fixed, they're not going to warn you about it. They're just going to say, I did it. I'm done.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And at worst, they'll find a way to sabotage the process completely, consciously or unconsciously. When you have, but again, that's compliance. When you have commitment, that's a different story.
Right.
And I think that this commitment is practically always a result of the influencer not just understanding, but really embracing the message of that Dale Carnegie wrote in his classic How to Win Friends and Influence People, where he wrote that ultimately people do things for their reasons, not our reasons. So the great influencer continually questions themselves. How does what I'm asking this person to do align with their goals, their needs, their wants, their desires? How does what I'm asking this other human being to do, how does that align with their values? And when asking ourselves these questions intelligently and authentically, I mean genuinely, not as a way to manipulate another person to do our will, but as a way to help that person as well, we've come a long way toward earning that commitment. And again, I'll go back to our mutual friend Dondi Scumaci, what she says about this. It's one of my favorite, what I call Dondi-isms, because people who know Dondi know she's got these wonderful, wonderful sayings. And what she says is that compliance will never take you where commitment can go. And
good
I think
point.
It's so powerful. Compliance will never take you where commitment can go. In other words, great leaders, great influencers understand that when it comes right down to it, it's not about them. Great leadership is never about the leader. Great influence is never about the influencer. And great salesmanship is never about the salesperson. Who is it about? Mm-hmm. It's about the other person. It's about everyone whose lives you choose to touch. It's about everyone whose lives you choose to add value to, whether it's family or friend or associate, employee, employer, whether it's that the supplier or the committee member or the person at the customer service desk who's not providing good customer service. You've got to find a way to tie what you want into what they want.
And I think you said something so important there. I just wrote it down. That you're influencing people that you choose to add value to.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's so important because people, during the course of the day, I don't think we understand the impact we have on people. We really don't. I mean, just to give you a quick example, and it was one of those small things that just stuck in my head, because I'm a total introvert. I hardly ever leave my house unless I just have to. I'm happiest in my own head and in my garden and. It's a very busy, it's an interesting place inside my head.
Well, other than
and
the
I
garden that I don't, which I don't have, I'm the same as you. I live in my head. I very rarely go out. I have my 1 mile radius around my house. that I have everything there that I need. Unless I'm traveling to speak, I'm home.
Oh, you and me both. And listen, I have this gorgeous car. I've got a Range Rover. It's a very expensive car. It's in perfect condition because it doesn't go anywhere but to Walmart. I don't know why I have it, but I like it and I wanted it and it's mine. But But, you know, the thing, and I think I just lost my train of thought, but, oh, I know what I was going to say. I was in the grocery store, and this was some years ago, and stop me if I've shared this with you before, but, you know, I'm not somebody that's out in the Walmart in the aisles going, hey, how's your mom and them? I don't care. I'm in there with my list. I know where the aisles are. I'm in. I'm out in 15 mm-hmm. minutes. That's just all there is to it. Not a true Southerner in that respect. And I'm looking at this lady who reminded me just irresistibly of my mother, and this was in the springtime, I think, and she was so cute. Her hair had just been done, and you could tell she had just had her manicure and pedicure, and she was wearing these little jeweled sandals and this cute little outfit. She was probably in her 70s and or maybe a little bit older, and I thought she was just precious. She was just, she took such good care of herself. And the only thing I could think to say to her, and I'm not a people talker. I'm not. You know, I mind my own business. I go home. And I looked at her and I said, your shoes are so cute. She lit up like I had just given her a steak dinner. I mean, she was so excited that somebody would notice her cute little shoes and her little manicure. We must have talked for 15 minutes. She was a lovely lady. I've never seen her before since. But just the way that she lit up by that one little comment made me go, you know, Denise, sometimes you really do need to pay attention to other people. So I actively try now. I really do.
But, well, and I'm sure you touched a lot of lives with doing that, like you touched hers. That's just not something that, you know.
So darn cute. Mm-hmm. She really was. But her reaction just really took me aback once I got in the car and went, what just happened there?
Mm-hmm.
And it stuck with me all these years, and that was probably 5 years ago.
Mm.
But you just don't know. So I think what I'm saying is sometimes you have to really be careful what you say to people, even though you may not mean it. You know, it may just be something that pops out of your head. And
well, sure.
Sometimes you have to go, oh, boy. Okay,
well,
that's
where tact comes in, though. It means you
yeah.
do edit your speech. It means you think about what you're going to say before you say it. And
I've had
to
learn that, Bob. It's not native to me. Trust
sure.
me. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you talk about that in your book, too.
Yeah, but it's a credit to you that you did learn it. There's so many people who don't, and they continue to just speak, you know, without saying anything. It's like a fired gun. You know, once you hear the sound, it's done. You know, you can't
yeah,
take it back.
Yeah, exactly. I know you talk about tact, and you talk about the lessons that your dad taught you about tact, and I think that's so important because, as I said, tact is not native to me. It's something that I struggle with,
mm-hmm.
and I have to just say, okay, do you? And I'm able now to take that half a heartbeat and go, don't say it
mm-hmm.
most of the time. But sometimes it still pops out. But I'm learning. But talk about tact, if you don't mind, because I think that is such a huge part of being an influencer and really helping other people. And I think that's what influence is when you boil it down. Influence is really helping your fellow man.
Yeah.
I think.
Sure it is.
Okay.
And when you think of tact, I think of something my dad has always said. He's always defined tact as the language of strength.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when you really think about it, it's so true. Because tact allows you to do things that you ordinarily might not be able to do. Tact allows you to correct someone, to critique someone, to, dare I say, constructively criticize someone. And it's not that we ever want to do that. We don't. But we're talking about the real world, not a fantasy world. And there are times that people do things, whether it's, again, a family member or a friend or an employee or, you know, what have you. Somebody gives the wrong information to a customer, or they pay too much for a negotiable product, or they're not speaking respectfully to the other person, what have you. Well, we need to be able to teach that other person. Well, we need to do it in a way that not only is the person not going to be defensive, and not only are they not going to be resistant to us and our message, but they're going to be very open to it. They're going to be very accepting, both of us and of our message. And it's only then that it's going to be able to get past their ego guard and their emotion base and be able to get through and help that person to course correct.
You know, I have an oddball question, and I don't know if you have an answer to this, but I'm willing to bet you do. How do you talk to yourself? because let me tell you, the person I have to have the most talks with is guess who?
Well, sure. And I think many of us probably feel that way. And it depends what we're talking to ourselves about. You know, sometimes we make a mistake, and it's okay to feel a little badly about the mistake. You know, you maybe blew your cool a little bit, or you talked down to somebody, or you snapped back at someone that it really shouldn't have. And you know, it's okay to feel a little badly, but it's probably not okay to feel so badly that you cripple yourself and stifle yourself from being able to improve because you feel so badly it starts to spin out of control. But right. We can understand that we're human beings and that we are going to have we can apologize if that's appropriate or, you know, however we are supposed to handle it the right way. And that we're going to have another chance to try again because these situations are going to continue to come up. And we can always improve. And, you know, and sometimes we need to congratulate ourselves because we handled something beautifully that we hadn't before. And now it's just a matter of building on our small successes so we can continue the process.
I like that idea. I think that's probably the biggest thing that's left out when you're, you know, smacking yourself on the hand saying, bad Denise. You know, instead of, well, you know, you do what you have to do. You, like you say, you apologize or you file it away for a further review or you just say, I'm not going to do that again. Mm-hmm. But I think it's easy to not recognize that you also have to celebrate your wins.
Yeah. Yeah, very important.
Yeah. I'll have to put that down on my to-do list. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. You talk about the very first thing that when you open up this book, one of the very first things that you see in chapter one are the five principles of ultimate influence. Do you mind sharing those?
Not at all. Number one, we've discussed a little bit, and that is to control your own emotions. That's where it all begins. Until you can do that, it really doesn't matter that you can do anything else because you're never going to get to that point that you can. So controlling our own emotions, being the boss of ourselves is so important. Number two is to understand the clash of belief systems. Number three is to acknowledge their ego. Number four is to set the proper frame. And number five is to communicate with tact and empathy.
Okay, what do you mean by clash of belief systems?
We're not talking
religion here, right?
I mean, no, I guess that wouldn't be included, but no, that's not what really, that's not the gist of what we're talking about.
Okay.
What is a belief? I mean, when you think of it, a belief is a subjective truth. It's the truth as we understand the truth to be, which doesn't mean it's the truth. It just means it's our belief or our truth.
Right. The operating word being subjective.
Exactly. And now this belief system that we have is really a combination of upbringing, environment, schooling, news media, television shows, movies, cultural mores, everything we touch, taste, hear, see, smell, what have you. Now, the interesting thing about our belief systems is that it was given to us. You know, we really did not consciously decide on it or take it in. It was given to us, by people who were given their belief system, who were given it by people who were given their belief systems, and it's established by the time we're little more than toddlers. Our belief system is pretty well set, and it's not that it can't change, but it usually doesn't. And most people go through their entire lives never even realizing, never being aware that they are being run by an operating system, their belief systems, that they don't even realize is running them.
It's so funny that you should say that, Bob, because I had that I honestly came to that this morning, and it's about, of all things, laundry. I hate doing laundry. I don't know why. I just hate it. And all of a sudden, I had this flashback of the laundry that would pile up in my childhood garage, literally pile up. And I don't do that because I've consciously made that decision, you know, growing up that I didn't want to have this big mess anywhere. I'm very tidy. But it occurred to me that that's where my absolute detestation, is that even a word, of doing laundry comes from.
And if it isn't a word, it should be.
It's detestation. Let's make it a word. But I'm standing in my kitchen going, oh, I've got to pull the laundry out. I've got to go. You know, and I could feel my spirit just kind of sink. It's a 3-minute job. Why I make it a big deal in my head, I have no idea. But I do now because I hated it when I was a kid, and I deliberately took myself back to that garage where the laundry was piled up, and it would get moldy because people would throw wet stuff on top of other wet stuff, and it was almost a childhood trauma that I never recognized until just now. Well, there it is. Now I know why I believe I hate doing laundry. I really don't. I just hate the memory. So now I have to change my mind about it. I'm working on it.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you dug into why you felt or believed a certain way. And until we do that, we really don't know. We really don't know. Now, so what's interesting is that we're run by this operating system, our belief system, that we're not even aware we're being run by, and so is the other person. This person with whom you're about to have a difficult or challenging personal interaction, they're run by a belief system as well, and everything they're thinking, saying, and doing is basically run by this unconscious programming. So you've got a real clash there in and of itself. Now put something on top of it, which is just as insidious, and that is, as human beings, we tend to believe that everybody else sees the world as we see the world. When you think of it, how could it be any other way? We don't know any other way of seeing it other than the way we see it. So, which is why you often hear people saying things like, oh, everybody feels that way, or nobody likes that. And you may have even said yourself or heard someone say, oh, I would never say that to someone, right? Because, well, you wouldn't, but someone else would, because that's their belief system. And so what we need to do when I say understand the clash of belief systems is I'm not necessarily saying that you will need to understand that person's belief system. You probably can't really understand it because they don't even understand it. You just need to be aware that they are most likely coming from a whole different set of beliefs or way of looking at the world than you are. And as long as you understand that, Denise, now you've created a context or an environment where you can act appropriately and do something about that.
Can you frame that up in a way that gives people, like, you know, can you give me an as if, you know, something that may have happened?
Oh, well, look at how many times let's say someone forgets a birthday, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And this person is just livid that this friend of theirs forgot their birthday. Well, in this person's family growing up, birthdays were a big thing. I mean, it was just celebrated. It was like, I mean, the person was king or queen for a day, everybody, right? In this other person, though, their family, it was kind of just another day. You know, they may acknowledge it, but they could have gone a whole day without even knowing it. And this person doesn't dislike birthdays. They just don't care. It's just not something that matters.
Right.
Well, this first person, but if they were my friend, they would have, you know, made a big thing. They'd have remembered it and got right. Well, you know, it sounds silly, but it's not. It's a person's belief system. It's their operating system. It's how they see their world.
I hear wives say this all the time. Well, he ought to know this about me. Really? Seriously? No, he's a man. You're a woman. No. No.
Well, I think as human beings, we often we see other people's actions through our lens.
Right.
And we assume they know what we're thinking because, again, or they should know what we're thinking because, again, why wouldn't they? This is the way the world is. My friend Judy Piani, who wrote a book called Trait Secrets, she says her refrain through the book was, normal is what I am. You know, we just assume the way we are, the way we see it. In fact, in the book, in Adversaries into Allies, I talk about the book by Dr. Gary Chapman, Five Love Languages, which was such an amazing book.
Mm-hmm.
And really this has to do with belief systems. He talks about the ways we receive love. And one person's love language might be physical touch, another's is words of affirmation, and another person's is acts of service, and another's is quality time, and another's is, I can't remember the fifth one, but you know, they're all good, and they're all the way a person primarily receives love. But here's the thing. This person, typically, who receives love in a certain way, they assume that their partner would also want to receive love that way. Why not? How else? Normal is what I am. You know, everybody believes as I believe. And so you've got two people, one whose love language is quality time and the other's whose is acts of service, and this person
right.
doing acts of service for the other person can't understand why that person doesn't feel appreciated and doesn't express their thanks, and the other person mm-hmm. doesn't understand why they're all this quality time they're going out of their way to spend and the person doesn't seem to appreciate it. Well, again, it's not right or wrong. It's just subjective truths. They each believe.
Right.
They each
right.
see something different. And, of course, again, it's unconscious until you know enough about it to make it conscious.
Good point. It is difficult. You know how I kind of figure these things out? I have multiple cats, and each one of them has different personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And not one of them can speak to me to tell me what they want. So
mm-hmm.
I have to figure it out.
Yeah.
And it's a good lesson in life, I find. You know, the vicar wants one thing. He has to be held a certain way. Sawyer Griffith's completely different from all the rest of them. He's 17 years old and cranky. And, you know, I think he can talk. I think he just won't. I think if you observe your pets, if you have pets, and understand the massive differences between them, even if you've got five cats or six cats or two cats lined up in a row, they're completely different,
mm-hmm.
and you have to communicate with them differently.
Yeah.
And it might be simple, but it works for me. I view people as cats. You know, I understand
mm-hmm.
that I'm not going to know everything about them. I just need to observe them enough to know how to approach them.
Yeah, it's very wise.
Well, it keeps me out of trouble.
Yeah.
I don't get swiped or hit or bit or anything else. It just makes sense to me to stand back and observe and really listen
mm-hmm.
before I run my mouth, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But that may be part of being an introvert.
That is true. We do tend mm-hmm. to think things out
mm-hmm.
and so forth. And yeah, absolutely. We live inside our heads.
Oh. Gosh, you have no idea. My head is a fascinating place, I have to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
Ego. I know you talk a lot about acknowledging their ego, and that sounds to some people, and I can feel the eyebrows in the audience raising. What? How do you acknowledge somebody's
yeah.
ego without
well,
punching
and
them
by
in the
that,
face?
I don't mean you say to the person, hey, pal, your ego. You know, that would have the opposite result. And no, it's just acknowledging
right.
that if that person is acting in a way that's not productive but is probably counterproductive, it's not logical, it's not helpful, and so forth, there's a good chance that their ego is getting in their way, that their ego is controlling them, much like emotion. And there's a big tie-in
mm-hmm.
from, you know, with ego and emotion. And and we need to understand that. We need to acknowledge that, because if we don't, then we're going to be wondering why, as much as we're trying to help, and as much as we're trying to do the right thing, nothing's happening. So we need
right.
to acknowledge that their ego. We need to be aware of that ego, and we need to keep that in mind. Really, when you think of it, so much of persuading and influencing another person is making them feel good about themselves. And
indeed. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you don't acknowledge their ego and how big a part of it that is, then you're going to sort of be behind the eight ball.
So instead of dismissing them as, you know, there's so many words that come to mind, idiotic, infantile, low IQ. I mean, there's so many ways that you can just be so dismissive of somebody without understanding that they're coming from their own frame of knowledge, you know, their
mm-hmm.
own subjective area. So you're saying that, you know, don't immediately dismiss somebody, really look at them and see how you can kind of step in and help out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Great way to put it.
Now, how do you set the proper frame for this, though?
Well, a frame is an interesting thing. It's so very important, because if you set the right frame, you're really, you know, you're nine steps ahead of the game in a 10-step
mm-hmm.
game. A frame is simply the foundation from which everything else emanates. I give you an example from the book. I talk about being in a Dunkin' Donuts store, and there was a little boy.
Dunkin' Donuts, not you.
No, me never. Oh, that, no.
And, for our audience, he lives there, just so you know.
And there was a little boy. He was probably about two and a half years old, and he was kind of running around the store playing. And he started to walk back toward his parents when all of a sudden he took a spill on the floor. He just fell. And, yeah, he didn't hurt himself. He didn't fall hard, but you could tell by the look in his face that that he intuitively understood that was not supposed to happen. And he immediately looked at his mom and dad for their interpretation of the event. What happened happened. He wanted to know what was next.
I believe
that had his parents reacted in panic. Oh no, my poor baby. Oh, you must be hurt. He probably would have gotten upset and cried because he could have gone either way with that. But what they did is they really handled it beautifully. They clapped and they smiled and they said, "Oh, that's such a good trick. That looks like so much fun." And he started to giggle and laugh and have a good time. Yeah, and what they did is they set a very productive frame for him to work on. And, you know, this can be as easy as a genuine smile when you first meet someone. It can be opening up your body language when someone wants to join a conversation and you're kind of letting them know, you're setting a frame that it's open, that they're welcome to join. It could be that when when you have to talk to the supervisor because you're not getting the satisfaction that you need from the frontline person, that when this person comes out expecting a nasty customer who's going to fight and argue and so forth, instead you have a smile on your face, you walk toward them with your hand outstretched, and you say, "Oh, hi, Mr. Johnson, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to see me. I know you're very, very busy." And, you know, you've right there, you've reset the frame. You've established the frame in which this person wants to help you. You're the type of, you're the exact type of customer they will go out of their way to help. So it's actually very easy to set the proper frame because most people will pick up on the frame that you set. So it really is up to you. I often say that in any potentially difficult situation, a frame will be set. The only question is, who's going to set the frame? Are you going to set it or the other person? And if the other person sets the frame, what happens is you're depending upon luck, that person's going to know about frames, that they're going to, if they don't, they're going to intuitively set the right frame, and there's no guarantee. But when you are the one that sets the frame, now you can be sure that it's going to go into the direction that you want it to go in, assuming you've set it correctly.
And I would think, Bob, if you're aware that the frame is being set on their part, that you can consciously reframe it.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I call it resetting the frame. And it's actually very, very easy to do that.
Yeah, I know. I do it all the time. So, listen, there's one question that you ask. You say that this is a very common question that's pretty much guaranteed to keep a potential misunderstanding from ever actually taking place. You got to explain that one.
Well, this has to do with belief systems again, because two people can agree on something but not really agree because they are talking about two different things. And that is the cause of so many misunderstandings. Just a very simple example, a fun example, might be that you and your friend decide to meet the next afternoon at 5 o'clock at the beach. And so you go to the meeting place on the beach where everybody who goes to the beach meets, and your friend's not there. You got stood up. And the next day you say, "Where were you?" And they say, "I was there right at 5 o'clock. "No, you weren't." "Yes, I was." "No, you weren't." "Yes, I was." Well, it turns out that while you were at the beach, the one near the ocean, they were at this new restaurant called The Beach. And so, you know, same word, but two different explanations. You know, the team leader comes and tells his or her team, the client just called, "There's a change now. We're going to have to get the project done as soon as possible." Well, what does "as soon as possible" mean? You could have four different people on the team, one assuming it means overnight, one means the end of the week, with the other it means as soon as we get done with the other one, and the other one thinks it means it does. Just depends on a whole lot of things, company culture, what that saying meant when they were growing up, a whole lot of things. So what you might say, and here's where the question comes in, you simply ask them what they mean by, or to define what they mean, but you would say it in a way that's kind and tactful. You might say, "Dave, just for my own clarification, when you say as soon as possible, is there a you had in mind?"
Right.
Okay, and now they're going to have to define exactly what they mean by as soon as possible. Now, the key, though, is you always want to make sure you do that. If you're the one that says as soon as possible, you need to stop yourself. And you need to say, "No, wait a minute. When I say as soon as possible, I know what I mean, but do they know what I mean?" And so then we need to clarify that we all understand that it's the same thing.
And that's so important. You know, I work with a large team. You know, it's kind of like herding goldfish on any given day.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to be very, very specific about what I want. But you know what else is important? I need to let them see the bigger picture so that they're not just locked in their little box. This one's not just working on AWeber, and
mm-hmm.
this one's not just working in Infusionsoft, that they can say, oh, really, this is where you want to go? Because I explain what the ultimate result needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then I ask them to come back and give me suggestions. You know, if they have them, I am happy to take them.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a good way to get more out of a team if you let them see the bigger picture and let them be part of the bigger picture.
Well, that's one reason why you're such a great leader. A lot of people don't do that.
Well, it's common sense, again, to me. Do you know, Bob, we're out of time. We do this every single time.
Wow.
I know, and I still, I mean, I've got two more pages of questions I want to ask you. Would you come back and talk about the book again sometime soon?
I would absolutely love it. I'd be honored.
Oh, thank you. I would be glad, because I've got some, the book is great, by the way. Everybody needs to go get this book. Bob, tell them where they can find you and find the book. And
sure, they can go to, and they can go to burg.com, which is my main website. And while they're there, they can, on the right-hand side, there's a graphic of the book. They can click on that. It will take them to a page where they can get chapter one to see if they like it first. They can also connect with me on the various social media. We have all that at the main page. And they can check out our Go Givers International member community. By clicking on the button and joining us. It's a worldwide group of people who run their lives and conduct their businesses according to the five laws. There's lots of back and forth, feedback, exchange. We get mm-hmm. great expert guests. So it's a lot of fun.
I know a lot of the people in that group, and I'll tell you what, they're a great group of people.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for coming back and visiting with me today, and I really look forward to having you come back again soon.
Well, thank you, my great friend. It's always my pleasure. You're always a delight.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Right back to you. I don't even know how to be gracious about that, but you know what I mean. It's always my pleasure and my delight to speak with you.
Thank you.
Well, listen, everybody, thank you for joining us, and this interview will be available for download in about an hour, and you can also find us in iTunes. Just type in our names, Denise Griffiths and Bob Burg, the fabulous Bob Burg. And I will see you. You can leave fabulous out, but Bob Burg will do it. He'll get you there. And I will see you next week. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottogovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.